from the Samira Foundation, this is Demystifying NMO and MOG, where we bring together the world's foremost experts, the doctors dedicated to studying it, and the patients who live with it every day. With support from Genentech. You may recognize today's guest from social media as Dr. Gretchen, who shares excellent videos about physical therapy and exercise as part of her Missing Link Wellness program. Gretchen Hawley is a doctor of physical therapy and a multiple sclerosis certified specialist. She's been a popular keynote speaker at several MS conferences and also a guest lecturer at educational events and MS support groups. Today, she's going to share her thoughts on how a holistic approach to physical therapy that emphasizes the importance of adaptive strategies tailored to each individual's needs can truly make a difference in improving mobility, independence, and overall quality of life. Thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. To start things off, can you share a little bit about your personal journey and professional background that led you to your interest in physical therapy and MS treatment?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's actually an interesting start to the physical therapy because I was in my undergraduate schooling in a bio degree courses, and I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with it. But then I decided to participate in an event that the bio program was hosting, where they had a few of the alumni come back and share what they were doing with their bio degree. And the very first person to speak said that she was a physical therapist. And for some reason, it just immediately clicked, like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I want to do. And at that time, I didn't know what type of physical therapy or the ideal client that I would want to work with, but I knew I wanted to do PT. So I went to physical therapy school. And at first, I was more so interested in the orthopedic realm because I grew up playing lots of sports and working with athletes myself. So I got my first job in an orthopedic clinic. But when I was there, I had the privilege of working with two people around the same time that had multiple sclerosis. And I was blown away at how different these two people were. They were around the same age and they had the same type of MS, but their symptoms were completely different. And so that's when I really started looking into not just neuromuscular diseases and treatments, but specifically multiple sclerosis, because MS is a demyelinating disease. And as we all know, there's other demyelinating diseases too, but that's very different from other neurological diseases. And so I started working with these patients and doing research of best treatment strategies. And as we started implementing those, they were actually seeing improvements. And they said that when they performed PT before, it didn't really help. And so that told me, well, there's got to be something different between regular PT and this form of PT. And so it really was just kind of a random start. At least it feels random to me, but that is what catapulted me into becoming an MS specialist and really diving into this world.
Really interesting. The multiple sclerosis certified specialist, what does that entail?
So there is an exam that you have to take and, of course, pass. But before you even get to that point, it requires a specific number of observation hours where you observe a physical therapist who is already trained in treating people with MS. And fortunately, the company that I was working for had a sister company where we had an MS certified specialist physical therapist. And it was about an hour away. I was in Boston at the time and she was in Rhode Island. So there was one day where I drove up to her and spent the whole day with her and all of her patients and got to really not just watch what she did, but pick her brain about why she was doing each of those things. So you have to do observation hours and then, of course, study for this exam. I believe it's a four or five hour exam. And as odd as this might sound,
wow,
I loved the exam because it touches on so many points of MS, not just physical therapy. So this would be the same exam that a neurologist would take if they wanted to become the MS certified specialty, that MSCS. or nurses have their own, but occupational therapists, physical therapists, neurologists, et cetera, it's all the same test, meaning I needed to know all the information about diagnosis and all the symptoms and medications and, of course, physical therapy. But requiring the knowledge on all of that information helped me develop the skills to ask a broad range of questions on all these areas, not just strengthening-based questions or stretching-based questions. And it allowed me to learn how to develop a full treatment plan versus just honing in on one component.
Quite the high bar they set.
Yeah, it was intense to study for.
I can only imagine. In the book, you mentioned that traditional and orthopedic exercises don't provide the same benefit for MS-specific physical therapy. Can you tell us how demyelination affects performance and function? And then the second part of that is, why do MS and demyelinating diseases require a different approach?
When someone presents with an orthopedic injury, which could be anything from an injury like you fell and you hurt your knee, or maybe you fell and you broke your hip, or maybe you didn't fall, but you just have low back pain or neck pain, shoulder pain, maybe you were working and you injured yourself. Those all are categorized as orthopedic injuries. And when you have an orthopedic injury, you mainly focus on strengthening-based exercises for the specific muscle and muscle groups that you are that you've injured. So you're trying to rehab that and recover that. So if you had a shoulder injury, you'd focus on strengthening the shoulders, or even a hip, you'd focus on strengthening the hip. But when it comes to multiple sclerosis, you might have weakness in some of those same areas that we just talked about, but the reason and the cause is different. In orthopedic injuries, the cause is you fell, or you tweaked your back from doing a certain movement, or, you know, there's a muscular reason that you are having pain or limitations. But when you have MS or any demyelinating disease, it's not an orthopedic reason. The reason that you have weakness and or difficulty walking, difficulty doing movements, is because your neural pathways are affected. Whereas in orthopedic injuries, your neural pathways are fine. Your nerves are not affected the majority of the time. If the nerves are affected, it's something more like a pinched nerve in your back. But with MS and with demyelinating diseases, your nerves are affected. And when your nerves are affected, it can make your muscles weaker. So the approach needs to be different. And I have found this to be true myself. When a patient with MS or another demyelinating disease goes to physical therapy and they focus on orthopedic exercises, just strengthening the muscles in that area, oftentimes they tell me that it didn't improve their symptoms at all, that they were still not able to walk any better. Stairs were just as challenging. They were losing their balance because they were just focusing on strengthening the muscles. Whereas when you focus on strengthening the neural pathways through neuroplasticity, you're able to actually start seeing improvements because you're targeting the thing that's causing the weakness.
You talked about neuroplasticity. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it is?
Yes, I love talking about neuroplasticity because it's the reason that people with MS and demyelinating diseases are actually able to see improvements. And I think that's so powerful because so often when you have a disease like MS or a progressive disease or demyelinating disease, it can be so easy to feel like improvements aren't possible, but they actually are. And the reason that they are is through neuroplasticity. So for those that don't know, neuroplasticity is the ability of our brain to do one of two things. Number one, it can help us strengthen our neural pathways. And number two, it can help us rewire or reroute to find brand new neural pathways. So when I'm lecturing about this in webinars where I have a visual presentation, I have a picture of the brain followed by a picture of a nerve followed by a picture of the Hulk. And I think this is a really powerful visualization because in order for a muscle to move, we first need to have the thought or reflex to move that muscle. And then a bunch of neural pathways need to fire in order for that muscle to move. Then we get the Hulk. Then the muscle actually moves. So neuroplasticity is the ability to strengthen that middle piece, strengthen those neural pathways. And if we can't strengthen it, if there's so much demyelination that that is just not possible, neuroplasticity is also the ability to rewire itself. So if it's not possible to strengthen that neural pathway, our brain can actually find a new neural pathway. And that's the reason that someone with a demyelinating disease can actually see improvements in their strength, balance, walking, et cetera, by rewiring itself.
Are there things that we can do to develop our neuroplasticity?
Absolutely. And some of them are pretty simple and others are a little bit more intricate. But when we're talking about exercise, one thing that we can do, according to research, that can increase the likelihood of neuroplasticity happening is to do some form of aerobic exercise first before strengthening exercises. And so for a lot of my clients that I work with, leg weakness is a big symptom. And so I don't necessarily want to do leg-based aerobic exercises because then their legs are going to be so tired that they can't do the strengthening exercises. So I like to do aerobic exercises seated in a chair using my upper body. So we'll just do, you know, forward punches or upper body jumping jacks or arm swings, just something to get my heart rate up and get that aerobic exercise in, then we'll do some leg strengthening exercises, just as an example. So that's one thing that can promote neuroplasticity. Another thing could be adding a challenge. And there's fun ways that you can do this when you're making the exercise itself more challenging, or when you're doing something in between your exercise sets that's challenging. So my favorite example of this is the Bop It game. Have you ever heard of the Bop It?
I don't think so.
Okay, I'm actually glad to hear that. The Bop It is a classic childhood game. I didn't know that, though, until like a year ago. But I asked my friends and like everyone knew of this game. So anyways, it's this game that has lots of different things that you can do on it, and you use your hands for it. So there is a voice that will tell you what to do. So it will say, bop it. And in that case, you bop a button. Then it might say, spin it. And you spin a button. It might say, pull it. And there's a button that you can pull. And so it's giving you these directions. And there's a total of 5 different actions that it could have you do. So you're listening and you're doing. But the thing is, as you are successful with it, it speeds up. And so you need to make those decisions even faster because it's just saying these actions even faster. And not only that, there's music playing in the background and music gets faster as you're doing better and better too. So you can imagine it's pretty challenging, even for someone without any neurological or neuromuscular limitations, it's challenging. So you
it
could
sounds
do
stressful.
That. Yeah. You know, honestly, it is a little stress provoking too. So if you are prone to stress, it might not be your go-to option for adding challenge, but you could do that game, the Bop It game, in between your sets. So while you're resting, you challenge your mind in that way. Or another example could be while you're doing one of your exercises, you're counting down from 100 by 3s. So you're trying to add this mental challenge at the same time as a physical exercise. So that's another way. There's several. Focusing on exactly what you're doing. So focused attention is another way to promote neuroplasticity. Meaning if you're focusing on an exercise to lift your leg, you wouldn't also want to be thinking about your grocery list at that same time or planning what you're going to eat for dinner or thinking of what you're going to do tomorrow or what you're going to wear. You want to be focused exactly on what you're doing, looking at the muscle that you're trying to activate, seeing how much movement is there, and being really focused on that specific thing. So those are just a few of the things that can help promote neuroplasticity so that you're even more likely to reap the benefits faster. And one important thing that I want to add too is that when you're thinking about moving the muscles, it's okay if you don't have any movement in them. One thing that I like to share with everyone that I work with is what makes an exercise successful isn't necessarily the amount of movement that you see, like how high you're lifting your leg or how much you're bending your knee, but more so how much effort you're putting in. And so if you're really focused, even if there's no movement, which is possible with demyelinating diseases, if you're focused on putting all of your effort into your quads and tightening your quads or whatever the movement is, even if there is no movement, that is still beneficial for neuroplasticity, so that once those neural pathways do get stronger, you will start seeing movements. But so often people give up when they don't see movement. It's almost like they think, oh, well, that's not working. Okay, what's next? Give me something else to do. And I know it's not the easy answer to hear, but when someone says that to me, I'm like, even more of a reason for you to do it. So yeah, if you're trying something and there's no movement, that's okay. Keep going at it. That's the whole point.
Excellent. Makes a lot of sense. Is there a different approach from the initial onset of, we'll say, symptoms or injury during the rehab phase, so to say, versus a daily maintenance or symptom management philosophy?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So when it comes to onset, or, you know, if you're just getting started, it really depends on where you're at that moment. But one thing that's really important is the goals that you're working towards. So if someone listening is saying, okay, I'm going to try MS specific PT or neuro specific PT, the first thing you should think about is, what are your goals and or what activities are challenging for you to do that you want to be easier? And you might have a list of 50 things, that's fine, or you might have a list of one thing. But one thing, for example, that a lot of my clients want to be easier is walking. And it's really important to even get further specific with that. Is it the walking quality? Is it the less tripping? Is it the walking speed? Is it the balance while you're walking? Like, get really nitpicky, because that will help you with specific exercises versus just generalized strengthening. It's so easy to just get caught in, oh, walking's hard, let me practice walking. When in reality, it really should be more functional exercises. And the way that you figure that out is to pick a movement that's hard for you to do. So this is something that you could do at the onset versus just more daily management. So let's just say the movement that you want to be easier is walking. Then you break that movement down into as many components as possible. And those components are now your exercises. So if you want to improve your walking, let's break down walking. Walking requires that you can weight shift forward. So you can shift your body weight from the back leg onto the front leg. It also requires that you're able to bend your knee, that you're able to lift your knee or bend your hip, that you're able to straighten your knee, lift your toes. There's all these components of just a single step. So each of those things could be your own exercises. So you could practice shifting your weight forward as an exercise. Maybe try 10 repetitions of it. Or you could try bending your knee as an exercise. So that's usually where I like to start when I'm working with someone with MS or a demyelinating disease. Whereas when we're talking about exercises, just, you know, daily good ones to do throughout the day, more maintenance, we want to pick of those, which ones are still the most challenging for you. And one thing that can help you feel a little bit better perhaps is knowing that a single exercise helps with more than just one goal. So let's say you have a goal of walking better and getting in and out of the shower easier and getting dressed easier and XYZ. One of my favorite exercises is marching. The marching exercise can help with all of those things. So it's not, you don't have to feel like, oh my gosh, I have so many goals, therefore I'm going to have so many exercises. But for those maintenance ones, we want to pick those hardest ones and make sure you're doing those.
I had never realized how important physical therapy and exercise could be in the management of everyday symptoms before reading the book. And I really liked the way the one chapter you broke down the more common symptoms that people deal with, you know, fatigue, foot drop, sensory changes, spasticity, and things like that. And you addressed each of them and how they can go about making life a little bit easier. It all makes a lot of sense. And it was really interesting. We talked about how important PT and exercise is, but starting an exercise program can be really daunting. We may not know the type of activities that are best for us, what exercises to do. There could be time issues, or you may feel like you don't have access to certain types of equipment. There can even be that emotional aspect of even being afraid of getting hurt, embarrassed of seeing learning something and feeling awkward about it, or even just worrying about how we look or going to the gym, you know, around all these fit people. And so where do we start to set ourselves up for success?
This is such a good question. Everyone might be a little bit different, but what I do with a lot of my patients, and I think it's a really powerful place to start, is to start by forming your why. And this just simply means, why do you want to do this in the first place? And it's much more deeper than what your first answer is. So when most people say, when I ask most of my patients, well, you know, Brian, why do you want to exercise? Why are you doing physical therapy with me? The answer most often is, I want to get stronger. Or it might be more specific. It might be, I want to walk better. Or, you know, I want to be able to walk to and from work without tripping. So those are good things. But get to the deeper meaning of why is this important to you? And I put one of my favorite examples in the book, which went something like this. And so I asked my patient, why do you want to exercise? And she said, because I want to get stronger. And then I said, well, why do you want to get stronger? And she said, so that I can walk better. I said, why do you want to walk better? And she said, so she could walk outside with her family. And I said, well, why do you want to walk outside with your family? And I just kept asking her why to every answer that she told me. And eventually what it boiled down to is she said, I want to be able to go trick-or-treating with my son. And I said, why do you want to go trick-or-treating with your son? Like that was a fine answer. We could have stopped there. But I took it a step further and I said, why do you want to go trick-or-treating with your son? And she said, so that I can be an active part of his life. And that like gives me chills to this day. It's like, so the reason that you want to exercise is so you can play an active role in your son's life. How much more motivated are you going to be to exercise when every time you go to exercise, you think of that versus I want to get stronger? And so keep asking yourself why to every answer that you have and try to find that deeper meaning. Because I'll be honest, a lot of the exercises when it comes to demyelinating diseases, especially at first, are pretty boring. You know, you're probably going to be sitting and lifting a leg up and putting it down. It's a fantastic exercise, but it's probably very boring for you. So it can be easy to fall off track with those. But if you start with forming your why and reminding yourself of that why before you exercise every time, I think that's such a great place to start to at least get you in the right mindset. And then we can talk about the exercises that are going to be best for you to do. But that's where I like to start.
From the quality of life improvement aspect of things, are there certain exercises that people with demyelinating diseases should be focusing on more? Or
that's a good question. I feel like the ones that are more, what's the word I want to use? The ones that you should be focusing on are things that will improve your daily life. My whole goal for anyone that I work with isn't just that they'll tell me they feel stronger, but they'll tell me that their day-to-day activities or daily life feels easier. So in order to do that, you have to focus on the movements throughout our day that we need to be able to do. So I, right off the bat, will think of standing up, especially standing up off of lower surfaces like a couch or even a lower chair, a bench. And so that would be an exercise that you could practice. Practice standing up and sitting down. We could also, of course, break that down into functional exercises. In order to stand up, you need to be able to shift your body weight forward. You need to have the strength and flexibility to open your feet and your knees wider. You need to be able to bend your knee. You need to be able to push up. So there's lots of exercises that you could do in addition to practicing that full movement. But that's one thing. We're constantly having to get up and sit down. So that's for sure one thing I'd prioritize. The walking exercises as well, you know, breaking that down, which of those components are hard for you to do, definitely implementing some of those. And then other things to think about are getting dressed. If that's hard for you to do, let's come up with some exercises for that. Getting in and out of your shower, if that's something that's hard for you to do. So thinking about those daily activities, and then you might have lots of those that are challenging for you to do. If that's the case, pick one, because as I mentioned earlier, it's not a completely different list of exercises for each of those activities. So there will be some improvement in stair climbing if we're focusing on walking, but just pick one that you feel would make the biggest difference. Like, if I could just stand up, my life would be easier. My day-to-day activities would be easier. Then let's start there. So that's where I would recommend starting to help figure out where a good place to start would be.
You mentioned functional exercises. Can you explain those a little bit more and what those are?
Yes, functional exercise is my second favorite thing to talk about. First was neuroplasticity, then it's functional exercise. So functional exercise means to pick an activity or just a movement and then break that down into as many components as you can. Like the more components, the better. So let's actually go with the same example I just mentioned of standing up from a low surface or even sitting down without plopping down. Of course, you can practice standing up and sitting down as its own exercise, but it's so important to break it down into individual exercises as well. So if we're all sitting right now, let's say we're all sitting in the back of our chair reclined. The first thing that we need to do to stand up is to move from the back of the chair to an upright seated position. So that could be an exercise that you do where you recline back and then you sit up, recline back, and then you sit up. And it should feel like a core exercise. But if you can't go from a reclined position to an upright position, you won't be able to stand up. So that's the first step of what you need to do to stand up. So, okay, now let's say we're sitting up tall in the middle of our chair. We're probably too far back in the chair to be able to get up. We need to scoot forward. Without scooting forward, you're probably not going to be able to get up very well, unless you happened to be sitting towards the edge of your chair anyways. So once you're sitting upright, the next exercise that you could practice would be scooting forward and scooting backward. That's going to strengthen your core. It's going to strengthen your hips, your legs, but scooting is a component of standing up. So we'd practice that. The next thing you might have to do is probably going to be to open your legs a bit wider so that you have a wider stance. If your legs are too close, too narrow, that's going to make it even more challenging. So you need to have the strength to open one leg out to one side and open the other leg out to the other side. So you would practice opening it, moving one leg out and then in, out, in, out, in, and same thing on the other side. So you can see we're breaking down each step of what I need to do in order to stand up. And I'm doing those as exercises. Maybe I do 10 repetitions. Maybe I do 5 repetitions. Maybe I do some on one day, but not another day. It doesn't matter. But those are the types of movements you want to start incorporating into your routine. And I also want to point out, if that feels hard for you to do, because obviously I've been doing this for a lot longer, and because I'm a physical therapist, it comes pretty naturally to me. But if you can't break a movement down, like if you had a goal of standing up and you just think it's just one movement, it's just standing up and then sitting down, then I would suggest working with a physical therapist who can help you break it down. Even if it's just one session, it can be so helpful to have a set of eyes on you and to help you break it down so that you know what you should be doing moving forward instead of just practicing the movement as a whole. As I mentioned earlier, that is helpful. Practicing standing up and sitting down should be one of your exercises, but it's just a component of it. It's not the only thing you should be doing.
You kind of touched on this a little bit already. I know that if there's an exercise that I struggle with, I tend to want to skip it. It just makes that deficit worse. So how do we find that balance between addressing a body part or a weakness in our movement when we may not be strong enough to even do the exercise, like maybe a push-up or a squat? So how do we begin working towards progress?
Yeah, I love modifying exercises. I think this can be a really powerful way to improve strength and also improve your willingness to want to exercise or at least do specific movements. And there's lots of different ways that you can modify. So the first thing that I like to do to modify is often to change the position to an easier position. So one of my favorite exercises that I've mentioned a few times today is marching, which essentially is just, let's say we're sitting, you're just picking one leg up off the ground. So you're trying to bring one knee closer to the ceiling and then put it back down. But if that's too challenging, change the position. So maybe you try doing the same exercise, but standing. So you're standing and trying to lift one leg up off the ground and put it down. If that's too challenging, we can always try lying on your side, or maybe lying on your back, or maybe sitting but reclined backwards. There's so many different positions that we can do our exercises in. So pick the position that's easiest. And this is great for two reasons. Number one, it's going to feel easier for you, so you'll be more willing to do it. You might feel like, okay, I'm actually getting somewhere with this version. So that's one benefit. But another benefit is the easier it is, the more repetitions you'll be able to do. And the more repetitions you do, the more likely you're going to get neuroplasticity to work. Because one thing we haven't touched on yet is one thing that it requires to get neuroplasticity working and strengthening those neural pathways is to do lots and lots and lots of good quality repetitions. If you can only do 5 repetitions, that's fantastic. That's 5 times that your brain has tried to strengthen or rewire itself. But if you're doing an easier position and can therefore do 20 repetitions, even if there's rest breaks in there, your brain tried 20 times to find or strengthen those neural pathways. So the easier position, the more modified you do, the more likely you are to find those neural pathways. Then from there, you can move to a harder position. So changing the position is number one for me. Also, you could do fewer repetitions or you could go faster. Oftentimes, going faster makes it easier and slower, it's harder. You could try doing less movement. So instead of putting all of your effort in and trying to lift as high as you can, try to lift it half that distance. And that's okay too. You're still strengthening the neural pathways. So modify, modify, modify to the point where hopefully you're able to find a position or an option that is easier. And if you're not, as I said earlier, still do it and choose the position that feels like it might be easiest for you. And hopefully, over time, you'll be able to see improvements in the movement.
That's really the epitome of work smarter, not harder.
Yes, exactly.
So one of the symptoms that a lot of people deal with is heat intolerance. So obviously exercising, you're gonna warm up. So how do you offset the issues that come with heat intolerance and exercise?
Yes, heat intolerance is such a common symptom. And it's really tricky because so many things can bring on heat intolerance. Oftentimes, people think it's the temperature outdoors, which, yes, that absolutely can cause it. But as you mentioned, exercise increases your core temperature, so that can cause heat intolerance, or even a warm shower, or better yet, stress. As we talked a bit earlier, if you get stressed playing the Bop-It, your core temperature could rise and that can cause your heat intolerance to kick in. So, yes, exercise is one of those things that can actually cause heat intolerance because your core temperature rises by at least half of a degree. That's all it requires for one or multiple symptoms to worsen. So, with that in mind, if you know you're going to be doing something that could cause heat intolerance, be proactive. So, before you even start that thing, in this case, exercise, cool yourself down. That could include cold, cold, cold water, if you can tolerate that, or as cold as you can tolerate. Maybe it means a cooling vest or cooling wristbands. They have cooling clothes available now. There's so many different cooling products out there. Maybe it means a fan blowing on you, but cool yourself down before you even start your exercises and then keep doing that thing while you're exercising. So still keep sipping cold water throughout, have the fan on you or a cooling vest, and then also keep doing it after. So you want to find some of these cooling strategies that help you and implement them before, during, and after your exercise. And the idea here is that ideally we will prevent heat intolerance from kicking in at all, but at the very least we can reduce it. So even if it does kick in, hopefully it's not going to be as intense as it would have been if you didn't implement some of these strategies.
Makes sense. So inevitably, we're all going to have those bad days where symptoms just seem a little bit more than we can handle. Any thoughts on how to manage that?
Yeah, you know, on bad days, which could be a bad day for any reason, you know, it could even just be a high fatigue day, or maybe you fell, whatever it is. The first thing that I like to recommend is resting, but resting guilt-free. So often, everyone, whether you have a disease or not, rests with guilt. We often feel like if you're resting, you're compromising something else. Like, I'm resting, but I should be making my grocery list. I should be exercising. I should be XYZ. And I don't know about you, but for myself and the majority of my patients, that is not restful. You'll be done resting. Let's say you wanted to rest for 30 minutes or an hour. You'll be done with your resting time and you will not feel rested because you were not actually mentally resting. Maybe physically you were, but mentally you weren't. And our mental rest plays a huge role on our physical abilities. So number one, allow yourself to rest guilt-free. And one way you can do that is just reminding yourself that rest is productive. We grow up, we've all, I think, grown up in this culture where rest is bad and go, go, go. But that's just not true. We're able to do more when we're rested. So telling yourself that rest is productive. I should be resting. This is going to be good for me. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing would be, if you're having a bad day, modify and remember that something truly is better than nothing at all. As you mentioned earlier, I think you said it was a cold or something that causes this huge physical limitation. That happens quite frequently with a lot of my patients that I work with, where they'll get a cold, a flu, an unknown UTI, and their symptoms go haywire. And it's almost like they've lost all the progress that they've gained. They were walking so much better. Now they can't walk at all. But in those moments, they will rest guilt-free. And then when they can, maybe they'll do one exercise. And not only that, they might only do 10 repetitions throughout the day. So normally we might think of that as being nothing, you know, one exercise, 10 repetitions all day long. That's not even worth my time, but it is worth your time. When you start slowly to build yourself back up, you will notice an improvement in the speed of recovery. So don't feel like you have to do 30 minutes of exercise in order for it to be worth it, in order for it to help you recover. So modify where you need to so that you can do something rather than nothing at all.
That's great perspective. I think so often we think we have to work at this level that we've perceived in our head. And oftentimes if we are able to get there, we end up just ruining the rest of the day because we're so just wiped out. You know, or even the next few days, we're trying to catch up and recover from what we thought was going to be good for us. And it's just detrimental.
Absolutely. I think a big, big piece of exercising with the demyelinating disease is rethinking what exercise means. Because yeah, so many people, we think exercise, like if I were to ask a room full of 100 people, what does exercise mean to you? The majority of the people would say, like if I were to ask for examples of exercise, the majority of people would probably say running, or if you're in a gym, maybe treadmill, elliptical, jumping jacks, these things that, yes, they are exercise, but if those things are too hard for you, you might feel like, well, I can't exercise. When in reality, in my mind, exercise is the same thing as movement. Walking around your home is exercise. Getting dressed is exercise. If you have stairs in your home and you need to go up and down those even just once, that's exercise. And so thinking about the word exercise, make it mean something that you can do. Otherwise, you're not going to do any movement, and then you're going to notice weakness at a faster rate than if you just do what you can do.
Exercise is movement. I love framing it that way. It makes so much sense. So are there any recent advancements or research that you're particularly excited about in your area of work?
So one thing that I've been really interested in that could help with any demyelinating disease is remyelination. And I should say there's nothing yet out there, but you know, I've been keeping my eye on it. And there's been a lot of advancements in terms of understanding what we would need to have a therapy that would allow for remyelination. So without getting too in-depth, remyelination would be creating more myelin, which is huge because in a demyelinating disease, there's not enough myelin. The myelin is being withered away. So if we could create more myelin, that would theoretically, and what researchers are hoping, not only make more for, you know, from here on out for the coming months and years, we'd have more myelin to prevent future degeneration and demyelination, but also researchers are hoping that it could help recover previously lost symptom weaknesses. So remyelination in theory could be huge. And we've learned a lot as to what it would require, such as what cells we would need and what cells we would want to get rid of. And so I've been really fascinated by that. There's, again, no therapies yet to help with that. But one component that researchers have found that will be really beneficial when there hopefully is a remyelination therapy available is exercise, because we would need a remyelination therapy, a therapy to make more myelin. And then we would want that myelin to be dispersed throughout our whole body so that it's not just in one area, but it's on all of our nerves. And one way that researchers are thinking that could be possible is through exercise. So the sooner you start with movement in general, the more likely that will help you too if and when this remyelination therapy does come out. So that's something that I've been keeping my eyes and ears out for.
Yeah, that would be huge. I couldn't even begin to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Any advice on finding the right physical therapist? Because it seems like there's so many factors involved.
Yes. The first thing is if you have MS, know that there are MS certified specialists, and that is different than a neuro certified specialist. So if you specifically have multiple sclerosis, see if you can find one. You can find them by going to the National MS Society website, and they have a link in there called Find a Partner in Care. I believe that's what it's called. And you can find one there. I will say, though, that is not an all-inclusive list. That is only the ones that have applied to be part of that. So that could get you started, but also just calling local clinics near you, or at least ones that are within a distance you'd be willing to drive to, and just ask, do they have anyone who has that MSCS certification? If not, you know, it is sparse. There's not many of us. And so if that's the case, the next best, or if you have another demyelinating disease, would be someone with the NCS. N is a neurological, CS is certified specialist. So finding someone with an NCS near you, that might be a little bit more likely that you'd be able to find someone. So that's the first thing, is find someone with the credentials. But then the next thing is, once you find someone, even if it's an orthopedic PT, just a general PT, ask them what neuroplasticity is. And hopefully they'll be able to answer that right away. Not saying, let me get back to you on that, but they'll be able to answer and have a similar discussion to what we've been talking about today. So asking them, what is neuroplasticity? The second thing I would ask them is, how is our treatment, or, you know, our therapy, our exercises, how is it going to be different from someone with an orthopedic injury? And again, they should immediately be able to talk about neuroplasticity and functional exercise, because orthopedic, as we talked about in the very beginning, that's just geared towards general muscle strengthening, not strengthening the neural pathways. And then the third question I would ask is, what is functional exercise? Because that's going to, should be a huge component of what you're focusing on. So they should be able to answer that right away. So finding someone that you think would work, but then additionally asking them those three questions could be a really great option. If you're not able to find anyone, or you know, maybe they're just too far away, you can't get there, and they're not offering telehealth, there are some really great options to learn from virtually, which is one main reason that I started everything that I do virtually, is to help people who don't have access to someone in person. So those are some things that you can ask if you're able to talk to a person. If not, YouTube, social media, online programs, things like that.
That's great advice. A lot of times I feel like we end up making our choices strictly by availability, and we don't necessarily view it as we're interviewing someone. We seem to be hesitant to start really asking questions, to start looking at what their expertise are and exactly how they can help us, so we can find that correct fit. Excellent, excellent points. Thank you for that. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Oh my gosh, this is a loaded question because there's so many ways. The first place would probably be online. My website is drgretchenhawley.com. So drgretchenhawley.com. And that's where you can find all of my virtual work. I also have a book called The Missing Link, spelled the M-S-I-N-G link. I have a YouTube channel that's under Dr. Gretchen Hawley. I have a podcast called The Missing Link, and then almost every social media platform as Dr. Gretchen. So it just depends on what you like to listen to, if it's podcasts or YouTube videos or whatnot. And then, of course, I do have my online MS wellness program, and this is where I put everything all together. So it's my favorite exercises for MS and demyelinating diseases, combined with calendars that tell you which exercises to do each day. We have live check-in calls each week. So if you're the type of person where you're just looking for someone to tell you what to do and get your questions answered, the online program would probably be the best fit for you.
Any final thoughts?
My biggest takeaway would be to do that exercise of asking yourself the why. And then whatever your answer is, ask yourself why again. I would start there. Even if you're consistently exercising right now, it can always be helpful to remind yourself of why you're actually doing this. And your why might change over time. Your why might be different now than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So I would start there. And then trust the process, because one thing we haven't talked about is, yes, neuroplasticity does work, and its research shows it is helpful for people with demyelinating diseases, but it can take a while. It can take anywhere from a few weeks to a few years. And so trusting the process, really understanding what neuroplasticity is, that it does exist, that it can help with consistency and good form, can help you stay in it a bit longer, because you are going to hit those moments of, I'm just going to give up. You know, I've been doing this for 9 months and I still haven't seen improvement. You might see improvements at the year mark, and how bummed would you be if you gave up now? You only had 3 more months to go. So trust the process, as hard as that can be, and know that it is possible.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of your day and talking with us. There was so much great information, great advice. I really think the NMO and MOG community really has a lot to benefit from the conversation. So thank you again, and I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.